Welcome back to the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and I am here again with my bud, Ryan Pryor, to bring you part three.
Week three.
Spectacular PT 109 saga. So thank you for joining us.
PT 109, week three of four weeks.
A
month-long conversation.
We're nearing the end.
We're in the end game now.
We are. And we're really excited.
Yeah. And I think we're about to get into the real stuff, the stuff that is super exciting and super interesting, and I think people are going to find it super compelling. So let's just do it. Let's just talk about it, right?
Do we got a drink?
I am not. It's a Monday night, and I drank too much this weekend.
Oh.
So I'm having water. I'm having agua.
I feel very bad to say I'm not having agua. I'm having my traditional whiskey sour, and I'd like to note, though, that I am drinking said sour in my Kennedy Dynasty whiskey glass,
which is
fantastic. And I'd like to take a second to note that I did a poll on Instagram talking about this glass, and everybody kind of loved it. And, well, that was like a post that I did. And then I did a poll asking if anyone would be interested in buying them, and I got a ridiculously overwhelming response of people that want to buy these glasses. So I am currently trying to work out how that would go. It'll probably be like a one-time deal where I'll order in bulk and ship out. So be on the lookout for that on my Instagram page at Kennedy Dynasty, because I'm going to roll those out.
Well, I'm going to buy one. That's for sure.
Ryan, you don't have to buy
one. I'm going to buy one. I got to support.
I will send you one for free. Like, you'll get the first.
I love it. Go out and get your Kennedy so that you can drink along with our stories.
That's what I'm saying. Is that not so cool?
Yeah.
Like, the whole promotion will be like, have a drink with us.
Hey.
Let's talk.
I love this. This is fantastic. And also, little side note, for your next whiskey sour, try it with rye whiskey. Get some rye whiskey.
Oh.
I had one the other night at this lovely little restaurant downtown in Memphis, and they made it with rye whiskey and vegan egg foam.
Oh, that sounds funky.
I thought so too, but I tell you what, it was so good.
Well, if it's vegan, it's not real eggs, so it's not gross.
So you don't even have to do it with the egg foam, just do rye whiskey. Buy a nice rye whiskey.
I wouldn't even know where to start with that. Like, what is a, like,
it's just, it's at the liquor store. Just get George Dickel or any other, you know, just a brand. Find the mid-tier brand, a $20 bottle of rye. And
I'm going to do it.
And I would try it. It's, rye is smokier and very smooth. Mm-hmm. And yeah, best whiskey sour. And speaking of whiskey sours have some kind of water in them. And during PT-109's last mission, there wasn't a lot of water involved, except for the salt water, but the fresh water was what was necessary for survival, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Did you like that one?
That was a reach. That was another reach.
That was another reach.
That was a reach, but I love what you did there. Nice segue.
I was trying to get us back on track. I was trying to redirect the ship.
because we stay off topic, as people say. So
Not stiff enough.
Yeah.
So, on the night of August the 1st, 1943, Kennedy and a 13-man crew were tasked with what would become the PT-109's last mission. The Navy had received intelligence reports that said that four Japanese destroyers were making a run. Remember we talked about two episodes ago, we talked about the Tokyo Express, or maybe we talked about it last week, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
The Tokyo Express were making a run towards to resupply the Solomon Islands, okay? Navy reports had said that there were going to be four destroyers headed that way. Remember, the whole point of the Tokyo Express, as a reminder, was to take non-supply ships, non-ships that weren't designed to supply, like destroyers and frigates, and send them quickly overnight from Japanese bases, one to another, to resupply so that American raids, air raids, couldn't get them. One of the things to understand is that the reason we were able to do this was because America had broken Japanese codes. Right, Japanese like encrypted codes. You've heard of like encryption and things like that, like the Enigma codes from World War II and the Germans. We had broken those codes a year earlier. It was in fact those broken codes that allowed us to win the Battle of Midway in 1942. Okay, which was a huge victory for the Americans. It was the first major victory for the Americans during the Second World War against the Japanese.
Have you seen that movie yet?
I have not. I don't generally like war movies because they get it wrong most of the time.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I want to because Nick Jonas is in it. But, you know, that's really the only reason I want to see it.
I actually met, you're going to love this. I didn't meet Nick Jonas. I met one of his backup singers the other night on his most recent world tour.
Really? I was there, by the way. I went to the Happiness Begins store.
I won't say the name, but she was at a bar in Memphis that I was at for a little concert, little show, little club. So
that lucky girl, man. I'm a Joe Burrow fan for life. That's a problem.
That's okay.
But anyway, that is really off topic. That deserves
that's
a
super off topic. We're going to go back. So the United States had broken the Japanese, naval codes. And so, again, one of the things you got to realize is have you ever seen The Imitation Game, the movie about Alan Turing with Benedict Cucumber Butt? You know him? Mm-hmm. You know that movie?
Brenda Dirk, Cranber Scrunch.
Yes. Bender Snatch, Cucumber Bottle. Whoever is Alan Turing in that movie. At the end of that movie, they talk about how when they broke, there was this argument because whenever you break a code, whenever they broke the code, the Enigma code in the West, you can't just go about that by intercepting every single message and then doing something about it. Why? Because eventually they'll figure out that you broke their codes.
You didn't even let me think.
I'm so sorry. They'll eventually figure out that you broke their codes, and then they'll change their codes. So there's this really interesting dynamic at play during the Second World War where after we broke the Japanese codes, we couldn't just go after every single Japanese ship that we knew was going to be out there. Because if they figured out that we broke their codes, they would change the codes, and then we'd be starting from scratch. And so, but this night they did. They decided they were going to send PT boats out to try to intercept this shipment from the Tokyo Express. And so the plan was for PT-109 to head towards the destroyers in the Blackett Strait. The Blackett Strait. Before this had even happened, a larger detachment of American ships had been dispatched to actually engage them in a battle, and unfortunately had arrived an hour late. The Tokyo Express ships had made it by that ship. So now it was literally just up to Kennedy and a group of, he wasn't actually the commander. He was not the lead PT boat in this experience. But now, they tasked a group of PT boats to go out and try to engage these larger ships and blow them up to try to prevent them from resupplying the Solomon Islands.
That's a scary mission anyway, if you think about it.
Well, it was dead of night too.
And you're in a small PT boat, this tiny little quick boat, and you're tasked with taking on these huge ones. That's scary.
Not only that, imagine you can't have lights on. You can't do anything. It has to all be done in dark, because if you have any lights on, those boats will destroy you. So on August the 1st, a squadron of PT boats, one of which PT-109, led by John Kennedy, made its way for the Blackett Strait and into what would become perhaps the most famous small ship naval battle in American history. So each PT boat carried four torpedoes on it. All of the boats in the squadron combined had about 60 torpedoes total to try to attack four ships. Now, what was interesting about this is that these torpedoes that came in these tubes, they didn't find out till after the war, but most of them were defective.
Oh my God.
Either they would sink too low and shoot underneath ships, or they didn't have the right timing on them to be able to blow up when they were necessary. And they didn't fix this issue until after the war was over. Now, you could still destroy something. You could still destroy a ship with them, but they were very defective. In all, something like 50% of these torpedoes that ever got fired ever did anything. Many of them just malfunctioned. 50% worked as they intended. 50% did not.
Oh, my God. That's not scary at all.
So, but again, they didn't know this, right? They didn't know this till after the war was over. But by 8:30 that night, all of the PT boats are in a position, and they divide up this PT squadron into four little divisions, and it's JFK and three other boats. Kennedy's division commander was a guy named Lieutenant Brantingham. And so at about 8:30, in between 8:30 and 1 o'clock, all of a sudden, they see these Japanese destroyers on the horizon. Not see them so much as they see them on their radar, okay? And they know that they're there. And so they begin all of these divisions do fire their torpedoes, and none of the torpedoes hit a destroyer. Of the 60 torpedoes that were fired that night or attempted to fire that night, none of them hit a destroyer that it was supposed to. Meanwhile, the small little division that Kennedy and PT-109 was in, The commander of his small little division, Lieutenant Brandingham, who I talked about earlier, had seen on his radar that a destroyer was approaching and had driven out a mile away from the group of PT boats to try to engage the destroyers. But he didn't tell JFK that he was doing this. They were on radio silence because you don't want to be intercepted, right? It's all about stealth and it's all about sneakiness, right? Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, he goes off. When Lieutenant Brenningham's PT boat attempts to fire on one of these destroyers, a fire erupts in the torpedo tube on his ship, causing another one of the PT boats have to come around and disguise him, right, to put their boat in front of it, because the fire would do what? It would set off the alarms, the destroyers would see them, and blow them up. Now, you got to remember, radar back then was a new technology. It wasn't the kind of radar that we think about right now where we think, oh, it's on the radar. We can see 30 different things and you can see the shape and the size or something. Mm-hmm. This was primitive. It often didn't work. It was faulty. Brand new technology. Remember, the myth that carrots make your eyesight better was created during the Second World War to throw off the Germans to the idea that the British had developed radar. All of a sudden, the two PT boats that I was talking about, one of the command of Lieutenant Brandingham, realized that they're made, right? And so ships' PT boats had these devices that made thick smoke, thick plumes of smoke, because you would want to disguise. That's the only way on the open ocean that you could, like, disguise your position. And so they started pumping smoke, zigzagging away, and literally left PT-109 behind with two other boats, or with another, at least one other boat. And now all of a sudden, it's late in the evening. What they were told on the radio before the other PT boats were left was, find a way to figure out how to fire your torpedoes. Once you fired your torpedoes, you can return to Rendova Island, okay? You and the other two PT boats can return to Rendova Island. But after that, radio silence. No connection. No communication. Now imagine you're out in the Pacific Ocean. Now there are islands around you. You can see different things. And there are four giant enemy ships that at any given time could see you and turn their massive guns in your direction and blow you out of the water.
No, like the horror. That is terrible.
So PT-109 does fire its torpedoes, but it's nothing. And by after midnight, PT-109 is idling around with one engine so as to remain quiet. And it was a moonless, cloudy night. Of course, they didn't have any lights on because they didn't want to be detected. When all of a sudden, off to the starboard bow, one of Kennedy's men sees a giant ship barreling directly for PT-109. And then it becomes apparent that it is not going to move. Kennedy, in an attempt to defend himself, calls the crew together and tries to turn and rotate the PT boat in the direction of what would become to known as the Japanese destroyer Amagiri, and fire one remaining torpedo that they had, and he called one of his ensigns to man the anti-tank weapons that were on the bow of the ship to fire back. But it was too late, because in less than a minute, the Amagiri tore the boat in two. The sheer force of this Japanese destroyer ripping the boat in two, and the resulting sparks and all sorts of gunfire and things like that, lit the fuel tanks on fire, causing the water to literally have fire on top of it, because the fuel floats on top of the water. Two men on Kennedy's crew died instantly. Two more had burns on 70% of their bodies from being thrown into the water. And John Kennedy immediately goes into action. He swims out looking for survivors. Meanwhile, he's waiting on PT-169 and 162 to come rescue them. But apparently all they did was try to fire their torpedoes, missed, and then left the scene because they were afraid of being destroyed. Didn't go to look for survivors, didn't do anything. Oh, so Kennedy is literally by himself. Two men are dead. Two men are burning in the ocean. And there are seven other guys who are also out. Kennedy himself individually is able to rescue three crew members, literally dragging them in the water to different pieces of the wreckage. And all in all, there are 11 survivors. And now they're alone. It's dark, except for the flames of the fire. There are two dead men. Comes to be found out later, by the way, that the captain of the Amagiri had seen PT-109 and directly turned the ship to split it in two. And all of a sudden, you've got a group of 11 survivors, some of whom can't swim, two of whom are burned on 70% of their body, and all of whom have some kind of injury to them, not including John Kennedy, who has massive defects, of course, bodily defects and things of that nature. And they have to swim together to the nearest uninhabited island because there are Japanese bases on different little islands all around them and Japanese ships still moving in and out and about. Evading capture, they swim through shark and crocodile-infested waters. At one point, John Kennedy even having a life jacket piece of leather in his mouth, pulling one of the incapacitated sailors behind him until miraculously they make it to what was called Plum Pudding Island. And that's where we're going to stop.
Oh, you jackass. That's a terrible spot to stop. Are you serious? Honestly,
part three.
I have read this story 1,000 times, and I have never been as enthralled as this performance by you, honestly. Like, this is so wild.
So you often bill me as a history teacher and a historian, which I am, but I'm actually a theater teacher by trade as well. So
you guys, a man of many talents.
A man of many talents.
A master of none. Jeez, that's awesome. Without further ado, I'm going to end this, and we're going to pick up right here where we left off next week for part four. So join us then. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure you're following me on Instagram at Kennedy Dynasty. Make sure to check the show notes for my Amazon recommendation shop, for my merch shop, for YouTube if you prefer to listen there. And we will continue next week.
MacMahon, the Irishman, was burned so badly he couldn't swim. Leave me here, go on, he said, 'cause if you don't, we'll all be dead. The PT skipper couldn't leave him, a man to die alone at sea. And with a strap between his teeth, he towed the Irishman to the sea.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy.
Keep America strong.
Kennedy, he just keeps rolling up. Kennedy, he just keeps rolling up.